Thanks for tuning in for the March 26th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights a study on the effect of prolonged antibiotic treatment on cognitive performance in patients with Lyme borreliosis. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear an interview discussing the future of hospitals following a panel at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Please remember, we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University in Philadelphia. This week for the featured article interview, we're going to be discussing a recent article in this week's Journal of Neurology titled Effect of Prolonged Antibiotic Treatment on Cognitive Performance in Patients with Lyme Borreliosis. I'm talking with the author Anne-Elaine Berende from Radboud University in the Netherlands. Thanks for joining us, Anne-Elaine.
Thank you for having me.
So in this study, you and your colleagues attempted to determine if a prolonged course of antibiotics would result in improved neurocognitive scores among patients with symptoms attributed to persistent Lyme borreliosis. So subjects were all given a standard course of open-label ceftriaxone over 14 days and then randomized into an additional 12 weeks of either oral antibiotics or placebo. So I was hoping we could just start with you reviewing the results. What did you learn about the changes on neurocognitive testing in those two treatment groups?
Yes. Well, we learned that there's no difference in treating patients for 2 weeks or treating patients for 2 weeks plus 12 weeks of antibiotic or antibiotic treatment. At least there's no effect on cognitive performance tested with our neuropsychological tests, covering the cognitive domains of episodic memory, working memory, verbal fluency, speed of information processing, and executive functioning. And we tested on several time points directly after antibiotic treatment, but also after half year and after a year.
Our listeners are familiar with many patients who come into the clinic presenting with a concern about neurologic symptoms, be it cognitive symptoms or maybe other neurologic symptoms that they attribute to a previous infection with Lyme. So what are some of the key clinical clues for our neurologists who are listening that a patient might be suffering from neurologic sequelae of a Lyme infection?
Well, the most important thing is to be sensitive about erythema migrans prior to the complaints, at least a few months prior to symptoms. So an erythema migrans or a different skin infection, also called acrodermatitis chronica atrophicans, Lyme arthritis or neuroborreliosis, and of course your listeners probably know how to diagnose that, so I won't say so too much about it, but of course the neuroborreliosis is normally presented with a facial nerve palsy or a painful radiculoneuritis or meningeal radiculitis or Bahn-Wurth syndrome. Those are all important clues to be alert about, and if patients after this, one of these key clues patients have presented with, then you should think about persistent symptoms attributed to Lyme.
The patients in this study were drawn from a larger study published in the New England Journal a few years ago in 2016, looking at symptom-related quality of life. In that study, similar to this one, there was no effect of prolonged antibiotics on health-related quality of life. We're all familiar with patients who have persistent symptoms following a Lyme infection or tick exposure. Do you think your original study and the study we're talking about today are enough to confirm that ongoing symptoms are not attributed to ongoing infection with Borrelia burgdorferi if they've gotten those 2 weeks of appropriate antibiotic care?
Well, what our study only suggests is that in our population, patients with these complaints, then additional antibiotic treatment doesn't have an effect on their complaints. And our study wasn't designed to look for the cause of the symptoms. So it's hard to say that it's not an ongoing infection. Of course, in our study, we didn't check whether patients still had a positive lumbar puncture or anything, because it's a whole different study. So it's hard to comment on that.
So if we can hopefully try to establish that with the appropriate antibiotic course, we can say there's little evidence that there's ongoing infection. I'm hoping we could talk a little bit maybe about, is there a current understanding of what may be explaining some of the ongoing symptoms that many might refer to as quote unquote chronic Lyme? Is there an ongoing inflammatory or immune response? Is there some other process that could be a downstream sequelae of the original Lyme infection that is not amenable to being treated with additional antibiotics?
Yeah, that's a very important question, and I would love to give the answer, but right now that information is still not available. Although I do admit that if there's no effect of antibiotic treatment, long-term antibiotic treatment, is there then a persistent infection? Well, you can debate on that, I agree. And we do have scarce evidence for an underlying CNS pathology concerning the neuroborreliosis. However, there's no evidence, but to say then that it's not present, we still cannot say that, I think.
So for the neurologist listening, in terms of that antibiotic treatment, what do you recommend as the proper clinical approach to treating patient with persistent symptoms that either the physician or the patient are attributing to Lyme? So all your patients had 14 days of ceftriaxone before getting randomized to additional antibiotics. Would you recommend they all get a similar course of antibiotics if they haven't already gotten it? Where is the role of antibiotic treatment in management of these cases?
Well, I would definitely recommend to treat patients for at least 2 weeks. However, if they have already been treated for 2 weeks, one could debate on treating a little bit longer. Then I would say 4 weeks. This is the maximum length of treatment duration for late disseminated manifestations of Lyme disease, such as ACA and chronic neuroborreliosis. However, if there's no proof of active infection, then I would not suggest to treat with ceftriaxone per se, as an oral treatment with doxycycline might be just as effective. That is maybe what you can do also when patients are very anxious and still feel that they, well, that's a problem, of course. Many patients feel that they need to have been treated longer, but I wouldn't treat as long as in our study, obviously, as it wasn't effective.
Right. And I think we're trying to answer a really important question when patients come in and are getting round after round of antibiotic treatment. And hopefully the work that you've done can go to try and shed some light that maybe that's not going to help much and getting some objective evidence. I wanted to thank you for joining us and going through these issues with us. And hopefully we can see more work from you in the future about dealing with this challenging population of patients.
Yes, thank you. Well, I also hope that it helps the neurologists a little bit. And also in the light of the emerging the antibiotic resistance, it's important not to treat too long and too much. So I'm glad I might have been adding a little bit to this important problem.
Hello, this is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. For this week's What's Trending segment, I'm excited to be speaking with Dr. Stephen Klasko, president of Thomas Jefferson University and CEO of Jefferson Health. Dr. Klasko recently wrote an opinion piece published by Stat News on January 26, 2019, titled Dispatch from Davos, Hospitals of the Future Will Not Be Traditional Hospitals. This piece was written in conjunction with Dr. Klasko's participation in the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, discussing the future of hospitals and healthcare, which is what we'll be discussing today briefly. So, Dr. Klasko, thank you so much for your time and joining us for the Neurology Podcast.
It's really my pleasure. It's just as cold here in Philadelphia as it was in Davos, so no change.
Well, some things are universal and globally apply, as you noted in your opinion piece. There are several themes that emerge from this in your panel discussion with a number of healthcare leaders from around the world. And one of the central messages regarding new technology and how it may influence healthcare was to sort of embrace the disruption of disruptive technology. Where do you envision the most disruption to traditional healthcare models, maybe over the next 10, 20 years? And what advice may you have for our listeners as we seek to embrace it?
Yeah, so first of all, I think about 10 or 20 years, I think we're going to see just a whole different mindset and model have to happen. So, Andy, this is not new. There was a book written by my mentor, Bill Kissick, out of Wharton 40 years ago called Medicine's Dilemmas, Infinite Needs, Finite Resources. Sound familiar? And he was the first one to talk about the iron triangle of access, quality, and cost. And he said, if you increase one angle, like access, you either have to increase cost or decrease quality. He said, if anybody ever tells you that they're going to increase access, increase quality, and decrease cost, and it's not going to be disruptive or painful, they're not telling the truth. So So if you think about our politics, when the ACA came out, the advertisement was it was going to increase access, increase quality, and decrease cost, and it wasn't going to be painful. Well, that's mathematically impossible. So the simple fact is that mathematically, we have to change the geometry around access, quality, patient experience, and cost. That's going to take technology changes like AI. That's also going to take some cultural changes, and that's going to take some human changes. And I think all three of those need to happen for us to be ready to have that disruption. And it will be painful, at least at the beginning, for patients, for physicians, for hospitals, till we get to a steady state, just like it was painful in retail and travel when some of those consumer-centric models happened. So the fact is we're going through this model now where everything is changing. And I think the biggest change that will happen, frankly, is that we are not going to be hospital systems. My guess is that 50% of care that was happening in an office or a hospital will happen at home or something that doesn't look like a traditional hospital or office. And as you start to look at how millennials are handling everything else, you can start to see that they're not going to sit there on the phone, listen to 11 options so they can get an appointment next Wednesday. And I think that's what we're preparing for at Jefferson.
Well, and if I may ask sort of a follow-up question to that, you know, is all of us who work either in academic medical centers or in private hospital systems or even in individual practices, how do we approach that very short-term divide of traditional brick-and-mortar hospital systems and places of work and trying to consider how we may reach patients through these more personalized ways in the community and their homes, but also abide by current financial models?
Yeah, great question. You know, just the way we pay doctors and the way we pay hospitals, you know, there's a great Upton Sinclair quote. It's hard to get somebody to do something when their salary depends upon them not doing it. So, you know, we talk about going from volume to value, but most of us are still getting paid on volume. So I think what you have to do is be ready for a future. And as you said, keep the lights on in the present. I want to be Target and Walmart. And this is what I mean by that. When Amazon disrupted the whole retail industry, you know, by turning everything into E, there were some stores or retail outfits, oh my God, everything, nobody's ever going to go to a store again. We have to become all e-based. Well, they didn't do very well because they really couldn't compete with Amazon. There were others that said, boy, that's a fad. You know, I'm not going to get involved in that at all. Think Macy's, Sears, and Penny's. The reason I said I want to be Target and Walmart said, you know what, we're really good stores. What we do very well, and people are going to need us for what we do. But that whole convenience piece and the whole issue of getting our products out to where people are, that's real. So we're also going to be that.
Well, that's a wise view of what the landscape looks like. And as our listeners consider sort of that existential question for themselves and their own practices, I thought maybe I'd focus on another theme from your opinion piece, which I love, which is sort of the intersection between this technology that we see on the horizon, be it telemedicine, augmented intelligence, personalized medicine, et cetera, with the really critical need to continue to train providers to have as much of an emotional quotient as they do their intellectual quotient in sort of the next generation of the healthcare workforce. Can you comment on that and how do you see that affecting the future of healthcare?
The way we select and educate physicians, we've joined a cult around four biases, a competitive bias, an autonomy bias, a hierarchy bias, and in some respects, a non-creativity bias. We're just as creative as anybody else, but when we ask what got us here, we don't usually use creativity where most entrepreneurs do. So if you believe you're creative, you're going to be ready for change, et cetera. So it becomes especially key as we start to look at a future where there'll be augmented intelligence, machine cognition, and robots next to us. So think about this. We still accept physicians based on science, GPA, MedCats, and organic chemistry grades, and somehow we're just amazed doctors aren't more empathetic, communicative, and creative. And at the World Economic Forum last year, Jack Ma had a great quote. He said, when we created cars, we didn't try to get doctors to run faster. When we created planes, we didn't try to get people to fly. Computers will always be smarter than doctors, but they'll never be as wise. So, you know, we started one of the first medical schools in the country where we took a cohort and chose them based on self-awareness, empathy, cultural competence, and communication skills. We erased the objective criteria after they reached their minimum. I think the reason that that makes so much sense, Andy, is because, again, when you ask about what's going to be obvious 3 or 5 years from now, there's a 100% chance that there's going to be a robot next to me. I'm an obstetrician that's going to do a much better job of taking a picture of that baby, going through its database, and saying exactly what the trisomy or the chromosomal anomaly with that baby is. But when the patient asks, doctor, what does this mean? It will never get the fact that what does it mean means what does it mean to my image of a perfect baby. That will require self-awareness, empathy, and human skills. So we have to, starting now, look and create doctors, both through selection and curriculum, that are better humans, not better robots than the robots. By the way, it made sense up till now because we didn't have robots. So having us be part robot, part human made sense. A little bit like Spock in Star Trek, but at this point, that makes no sense when we're going to have really good robots next to us.
Well, I think that sentiment will also fall on important listeners here as neurologists, because I think that we as a subspecialty, perhaps as you as an obstetrician, really rely heavily on our human skills when it comes to patients right in front of us. And while we may have robots that help provide clinical decision support or may even be autonomous for certain diagnostic studies and treatments, I think you're right. You'll never be able to replace that essential human quality that we need to cultivate in our next generation of providers.
And we also have to start to recognize that some of the things we do in academic medical centers make no sense to people. So, you know, and your specialty of neurology is a good example. If somebody has a headache, they don't know if they have a neurologic headache, a neurosurgical headache, a psychiatric headache, or a family practice headache. But in most places, they have to go to, like, you know, four different doctors in four different places. That seems like a no-brainer to anybody outside of medicine. But because we're sort of cloistered in these departments of, well, I'm in neurology, I'm in neurosurgery, I'm in psychiatry, we sometimes make patients deal with that same kind of fragmentation, and it just doesn't make any sense.
Could not agree more. One last quote I wanted to highlight for our audience from your piece, getting back to Star Trek. You said the U.S. has strung together popsicle stick and glue federal policies that continue to graft Star Trek-level medicine onto a Fred Flintstone delivery platform. So being that this was an economic world forum that you participated in, there are disparities both here in the U.S. and around the globe. How do we evolve our delivery platforms to address those disparities at this intersect with modern medicine?
Yes, what I meant by that is, you know, it's just amazing. I mean, you know, I did my residency in the late 70s, early 80s, and it just is amazing the technology that has made caring for patients better. What is equally amazing is that while every other part of the consumer world has fundamentally transformed, you know, so if you think about it, the day after Thanksgiving, Andy, you can be on your cell phone watching Game of Thrones in your pajamas doing all your holiday shopping. But if you have a stomach ache, in most places, you're still getting on the phone, listening to 11 options to get an appointment next Wednesday. Now, the technology exists. We just haven't gotten our act together to make that change. John Sculley had a great quote at a panel I was on with him where he said, you guys have to stop talking about the technology. You have to stop talking about things like telehealth. So we don't talk about telebanking. We don't get up in the morning and say, I think I'm going to telebank. It's just that through a series of events, almost all banking has gone from being in the bank to being at home. Same kind of thing is going to happen in healthcare. And if we don't embrace that, then we'll just become irrelevant. One of the things that should concern us is the 28-year-old entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley that I hang out with basically have gone from, I want to sell you my product, Jefferson or University of Virginia or any place, to I'm going to ignore the incumbents. We're the incumbents because you guys don't get it, and we'll just bring our product into your town. So we have to be the place that they feel that they can partner with. The last thing I'll say about that is we have to get serious about how we can use technologies like IBM Watson and machine cognition to really, for the first time, have population health mean something. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And this came up in the World Economic Forum. It's ridiculous that in a place like Philadelphia, we have six academic medical centers, and we're pretty proud of ourselves, but we still have the greatest discrepancy in life expectancy of just about any city in the country. And that's because we haven't dealt with the social determinants of health. So how do we start to use AI to make that happen?
Well, as we wrap up here, I think we've hit on a lot of themes that will resonate with our listeners, our neurology practitioners who are out there in the face of this intersection between traditional models and modern healthcare. Any final thoughts, perhaps a note of optimism to take away from today's interview?
You know, we have the risk of being commoditized, but if you look at what other industries have done, the antidote to commoditization is diversification and differentiation. And what I think is happening in a lot of places, and the real optimistic message is, how do we differentiate ourselves as an academic medical center? How do we differentiate ourselves in access, quality, cost, consumer experience?
And I'll sort of echo that final sentiment as sort of a call to arms that as physicians, as providers, obstetricians, neurologists, et cetera, it is so important that rather than watching this happen and being passive participants in it, that we take an active role in shaping the way that healthcare evolves to address these challenges, to take advantage of these disruptions, and to continue to infuse that wisdom that you eloquently noted on into our future providers. So Dr. Klasko, thank you again so much for these insights. This has been Andy Sutherland speaking again with Dr. Stephen Klasko, president of Thomas Jefferson University, CEO of Jefferson Health, about his piece, again, dispatched from Davos, Hospitals of the Future Will Not Be Traditional Hospitals. Check it out at Stat News. Dr. Klasko, thank you so much.
It's really my pleasure, Andy. Thank you for inviting me.
This is Bob Gross. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting paper on how serum neurofilament light discriminates Parkinson disease from atypical Parkinsonisms, and another article on results from the HOPE-3 study, focusing on the effects of blood pressure and lipid lowering on cognition. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.